Creepy algorithms from YouTube and Facebook. Digital shopping tips for the holiday season. And an app that will let you put tigers in your living room. All that and so, so much more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 6, recorded Thursday, November 9th, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Grammarly. Download Grammarly, the intelligent writing app, for free by visiting getgrammarly.com/twit.
And by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where every week we talk to the people making and breaking Tech News. I am Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell, and breaking YouTube, because I don't know if I can trust YouTube anymore.
Well, it needs to be broken.
That's true.
I mean, it is broken.
And in many ways, yes, it's been broken. But boy, this last weekend was a little bit of an eye-opener. As a parent, and Megan, you are a parent as well, we know all too well the power that YouTube has over today's children, the on-demand nature, the impossibly vast library, the fact that 300 hours of new video is uploaded to the site every minute, and that might be an outdated statistic at this point. I think that was less than a year ago, so that might be more than that now. It's easy to think of YouTube as the modern-day replacement of, let's say, sitting your kid down in front of the television set when you have something important to get done. But we're finding more and more that seemingly familiar and innocent content on the site could be anything but. Joining us to talk about this is Sapna Maheshwari, business reporter for the New York Times. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, it's great to get you on. You wrote over the weekend about YouTube Kids. That's an app that I'm very familiar with in our home. It's an app that YouTube released in 2015 to give parents more confidence that their kids are watching age-appropriate content on their network. But you say that there are dark corners even within this app. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So I actually only learned about YouTube Kids as an independent app a couple of months ago. And it came up through some advertisers who had wondered, you know, what else is on there. And basically, through some searching, I realized this kid-friendly app had videos that were showing characters like Mickey Mouse and Nickelodeon's Paw Patrol in, you know, committing suicide, or some weird videos exploiting children. There's one of a little girl from a country overseas with kind of a cut on her forehead. And these things were being automatically suggested to children because it turns out everything on YouTube Kids is harvested from the main YouTube site.
Wow. And now, obviously, YouTube created an app called YouTube Kids, targeted at for parents to have more of a sense of confidence around what their children are seeing on YouTube, because we all know as adults and very, you know, familiar users of the full unfettered access YouTube, that there's a whole gamut of stuff that you can find there, so you can get yourself into trouble very quickly. YouTube Kids, it seems, in this case anyways, is giving a false sense of security to these parents, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely from the ones I talked to. And the interesting thing was, you know, I didn't find these moms and parents on Reddit. They were posting to their friends and family on Facebook. And a lot of them, when you set up the app, it asks if your kid is in preschool or older than that, so they can populate your home screen. A lot of these mothers were saying, you know, I thought that meant this whole app was on so-called preschool settings. And so there's misunderstandings like that. That made them even more unprepared for the really disturbing videos that their kids then encountered.
Like so many of these tools, the algorithms are black boxes. Like, we don't really know. No, YouTube's not telling us. Facebook, none of these companies are telling us how these algorithms work at all. But from your research, could you tell if people were trying to, these video creators were trying to get on the YouTube Kids app, and were they trying to do it just to cause chaos or for profit, or why?
Well, a lot of that remains a mystery. I mean, but I think the most important distinction is this isn't satire in the way you think of, say, Family Guy, Cookie Monster being, you know, in a funny situation on one of those shows. They're very much targeted by the titles, to say Family Finger Song, which is a popular YouTube.
Oh, my goodness. I've heard that song so many times.
Oh. It's very catchy. I heard it once and I wanted to keep singing it all day.
So, yeah, they definitely said, you know, for educational purposes, for the entertainment of kids. I tried to reach a lot of the creators, and one of them was connected to a Facebook page where they kind of responded and said, hey, these are cute, funny kid videos. So they're definitely targeting kids. And then a lot of them, when you access them on the main YouTube site, we're running ads. So the best we can tell right now is, yes, they're targeting kids. And the biggest incentive so far seems to be money, though. You know, who knows what else, you know, what that might be.
Well, I mean, you know, this moment in time is continually kind of shrouded in the sense that people are starting to second guess, question technology, question big technology and the decisions that they're making, you know, because much of their decisions hinges on the fact that they're making money. And so, and their algorithms are making it easier for them to make money. But it turns out that those algorithms then turn around and have unintended consequences. I mean, when I've seen, like, I went into the watch history of my children. I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. My 7-year-old, by looking at the watch history and kind of keeping connected with what she's watching, she does a pretty good job maneuvering through this. I've talked to her about this stuff. My 4-year-old, I mean, she's 4 years old. She's, you know, not very old as far as that's concerned. So you can't trust that she has any sort of sense that when she sees this video of a snake coming out of a toilet in the YouTube's kids app, which sounds, on one hand, sounds innocent, but on the other hand, when you look at it through the eyes of a 4-year-old, like, they see that, and that can actually affect how they see going into the bathroom, like being scared to just walk into the bathroom anymore because they think a snake might actually come out of the toilet. And that's tame compared to some of the stuff that I saw in her watch history.
Yeah, absolutely. I talked to this really interesting doctor at Harvard, who, he's a pediatrics professor, and he has a punny blog called the Mediatrician. And yes, and so he's great, and he really looks at this stuff and told me that kids really develop such bonds with characters that they know and love, which are often what are being parodied here by these kind of external video makers. And I mean, and you can see it when you see little kids try and get an autograph from Mickey Mouse at Disney World. They think they actually met that character.
Yes.
And so they don't have a sense of irony. They don't understand, you know, when Paw Patrol characters die, they actually die in their mind. And that can be traumatizing. You don't know what the long-term effects are or short-term effects are, maybe nightmares for kids who are getting exposed to this stuff.
So one of the parents that you talked to in your article kept using YouTube Kids even after she discovered that her kids were watching some disturbing videos. Does that surprise you that she continued to use it even after it? She felt her child was traumatized?
Yeah, I mean, it was surprising that she was willing to. Her reasoning was that this is such a loved app by her child, and she didn't want to take it away cold turkey. So she figured she would just supervise him and watch it with him, which actually, when I talked to YouTube, their point was, you know, they kind of encourage co-viewing, which is what they call watching with a parent. But I don't know if that's necessarily a realistic way of looking at an app on a tablet or a phone. Where it is different from the TV. You can't necessarily see it from the kitchen if you're a parent that's cooking or something like that while your kid is playing or watching something.
Yeah, like I said in setting this up, I mean, as a parent who has definitely, you know, both of our kids have tablets, we I mean, they have access to our tablets anyways. We only really give them a couple of hours on the weekend. Throughout the week, they don't have any access to it. But those, I mean, they cherish that time. They look forward to Saturday morning, waking up and being able to have a couple of hours to watch whatever they want. They like being in control. They like having the ability to make these decisions and everything. And as a parent, you see an app like this, and I mean, you always know that you're entrusting it, and maybe you'll be let down a little bit, but to see that there are people creating content that on its surface looks very innocent. When you see the thumbnail, for example, you know, you see very familiar characters, copyrighted characters, and it looks innocent. But then when you dive into it and you really watch it, I mean, it might not even be outwardly like disgusting or, you know, sinister or whatever, but there's something very off about the pairing of this like plinky plonky lullaby music that if you're a parent in the other room, you hear the lullaby music, you think everything's fine. They're watching a lullaby video. But then when you really watch it, you see that Mickey Mouse is getting run over by a car, and that music is intermixed with this like deafening scream, and it's almost like you said, there's a monetary incentive here, but there also seems to be this undercurrent of just insidiousness with it, where it's like, you know, we don't know the effects that these videos would have on an untrained eye, a kid as young as 4 years old, but it's being fed to them through this app, and parents just need to be more dialed into what their kids are watching, I guess.
Right. And even when we were writing this story, my editors were asking, you know, are there other apps that have these same challenges? And at least definitely not on the size of YouTube, but you look at the competitors like HBO with Sesame Street recently, or Amazon Kids Studios, Netflix has a lot of popular kids shows. And there's bigger teams of people working to create original content in those situations. Here, it's just kind of fascinating and in this case, at least, a little bit horrifying to see what we know as user-generated content being served up to maybe unsuspecting three-year-olds.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even if these are just like chaos monkeys, people are like, I want to create the most horrifying video and then try to get at kids. There's still a monetary incentive here because YouTube is using an algorithm and not people to look at it and say like, you know what, that Elsa and Spider-Man video is disturbing. We'll take it out. So, I mean, is there really any way to fix this besides removing the advertising, the monetary aspect of this?
Well, you know, I think people are starting to think about that. One thing that's come up in conversations with folks is that YouTube Kids was not quite built from the ground up for kids. Like it's taking these videos from main YouTube and then pulling them over through algorithms. So who knows, maybe there are things they can do. Maybe they could rebuild the app in certain ways. Maybe they could vet them in different ways, but I'm not sure. I mean, it's definitely a new risk for parents. And I think it's a bit eye-opening. It makes you think a little bit about some of the safeguards that have been in place as, you know, the three of us were growing up that just don't exist on digital properties and for kids today and for parents today.
Yeah, it's definitely a complicated scenario. I mean, your children are a little bit older mine.
Yeah, I've still deleted YouTube just because of the waste of time. And like, I'll look through their history, and it's not that bad. It's like dropping iPhones off the, you know, tall buildings, that sort of thing. But it's just, yeah, I mean, it doesn't end after their kids.
No, totally. And when I look at a lot of this content, you know, and we've talked a little bit about the content being derived from these algorithmic choices, keywords, you look at the titles and it's keyword salad. And then they create content that matches those keywords. And like when I actually watch any of that, sit down and actually watch it, you just realize like there's no substance to it. There's the children aren't learning anything from this. It's just mindless, and I guess this is where I go, well, obviously I'm a grown-up and I don't get it, but I know when I was a kid, at least if I was watching something bad, it went through layers upon layers of people that were producing this to the point that it was professional enough to broadcast on television. Here, it's just like, here's a mishmash salad of nothingness, and we'll feed it to you for 2 hours, and that just doesn't seem like a good idea. That's where I stand anyways. I don't know if there's much more to say on this other than it just gives me the creeps. But Sapna Maheshwari, really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about this and for spending all the time in the article. It was a fantastic article.
I really appreciate that. Thanks.
Absolutely. NewYorkTimes.com. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
All right, have a good night.
After the break, more dangerous algorithms to worry about. But first, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. I've been using the Grammarly browser extension for quite a while, maybe 6 or 8 months. And I consider myself a bit of a grammar nerd. I'm the kind of person who cringes a little when someone says less when they really mean fewer. I know, you're out there too. And because I correct people on their grammar so often, it is important that I get my grammar right, because when I mess up, people really get upset because I'm always complaining about their grammar. Right, Jason?
That's right.
And if you don't like browser extensions, you can also copy and paste any English text into Grammarly's online text editor. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes. It also catches contextual errors, will help you improve your vocabulary. And it can also suggest style improvements, because everyone needs a little more style. Grammarly scans your text for common and even complex grammatical mistakes. It checks subject-verb agreement, modifier placement, comma splice, weak adjectives. You need strong adjectives, people. Stronger adjectives. And also, we'll find missing articles. They also use algorithms, and their algorithms are good algorithms. They're the good kind, developed by the world's leading linguists and language lovers. Improve your skills with Grammarly's detailed explanations for all your mistakes, and your weekly progress reports are very helpful to know how you're doing with your grammar. Write confidently and mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly everywhere else you write on the web. Be sure to check out Grammarly's Facebook and Twitter accounts for fun grammar tips and discussions. The Grammarly blog offers daily tips and insights on how to improve your day-to-day writing to achieve personal and professional goals. Get started and join more than 10 million happy Grammarly Chrome users today. Download Grammarly now for free at getgrammarly.com/twit. That's getgrammarly.com/twit, and we thank Grammarly for their support. While Facebook lawyers endure Senate hearings for allowing Russian troll ads, one reporter has been delving deep into a more insidious problem on Facebook: our shadow profiles. Kashmir Hill of Gizmodo has been researching some crazy stories about Facebook's People You Might Know feature. Welcome to the show, Kashmir. So, shadow profiles isn't an official Facebook term, obviously, because it sounds pretty scary, and it is. Describe what you mean by
They prefer it be called shadow contact information,
Oh, okay. That still sounds kind of scary. What does shadow contact information or shadow profiles mean?
So shadow contact information is, if you're on Facebook, you probably have this. If anybody you know or have ever given contact information to, if they upload their contact book, their contacts or their address book to Facebook, Facebook will try to match that contact information to people that are on the platform. And so maybe I've given, you know, Facebook my personal Gmail address, but I'd never given them my work address. But it'll see from someone else's contact book my work address, and it'll just kind of layer that on to my account. And then they'll use that for anybody I've ever, you know, emailed from my work address. They'll then start connecting me to those people. So it's part of the reason why you get those really accurate People You May Know recommendations, because they have this kind of like vast hidden black book of almost everybody you've ever been in contact with.
Yeah, I mean, you've been covering this. It seems like you've been looking into this for so long, like people who are in
that way.
In therapist's office, and then suddenly like someone else that's in the therapist's office will get recommended to them, or their therapist will get recommended to them, all these kinds of things. So my husband doesn't have a Facebook profile. He never has got an account. He never will, according to him. Does that mean, like, do they still know things about him? Because I have him in my, you know, because countless people have them in their phone book or in their contacts and have uploaded those.
So the reason Facebook doesn't like the term shadow profile is, I think that's what it implies, that somebody who has never joined Facebook still has this kind of profile there. And they say they don't do that. that any contact information that's been uploaded for your husband is just associated with the person who uploaded it, but it could be used to connect people. So if someone else has your husband's contact information, it could wind up being used to link the two of you. So yeah, Facebook does say they don't maintain shadow profiles for non-users, but it's certainly the case that non-users have information that's part of the network.
Yeah, I feel like it's convenient semantics, really. You know, sure, there is no profile for these people that aren't on Facebook that you can go to and view and see what they're, you know, what they like to do for fun. But still, that information is there and just as linkable once that person, if and when that person decides to sign up, everything kind of gloms on and, you know, they get the recommendations that are applicable and everything. All that data is there waiting to be put to work. It just seems to me like, I mean, could you see possibly legislation at some point forcing Facebook to not track this stuff? Or is that just simply not possible due to the fact that everybody has their own contact network that they upload and it's just so far out of anyone's hands that it, I mean, how could you even lock that down?
There has been a very strong Twitter discussion in reaction to my story about whether, you know, this is allowable under the new privacy regulations in Europe, because it is like processing information about people that they didn't provide to the network.
Right.
This has been looked at. Like, there have been complaints about shadow contact information. It's been looked at by Canada's privacy regulator and the Irish Data Protection Agency, and they just haven't done anything about it yet. So I don't know if there will ever it'll ever be regulated. The thing that really bothers me about it is that you can't see what's right in your shadow contact information. So I suspect one of the stories I've covered is a sex worker who has never given Facebook any information related to her sex work. She uses a different name, a different email address, a different phone number. But Facebook's People You May Know started recommending her regular clients. So it was making this connection between her and her clients, even though Facebook shouldn't have access to any of the information that would allow it to do that. And she can't see your shadow contact information to see if that's what's to blame. So, you know, my hope would be that one day we might have more transparency and the ability to limit what the social network that we joined for fun is, you know, processing about us.
So another thing I learned from your article was that Facebook works as a reverse phone number lookup. So I put my phone number in there, popped up my profile. I put my husband's phone number in just to test this and nothing came up. I put my dad's phone number in and he has a Facebook profile and his profile didn't come up. So I'm assuming it's probably because of one of the many apps, you know, probably like maybe WhatsApp or anything that is associated with my phone number. And you talked to Bruce
Schneier,
thank you, about this, about how our phone numbers are really more private. Talk a little bit about that than our social security numbers.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering if I shouldn't have given up one of my journalistic tricks of the trade. I have definitely used the reverse phone lookup before for stories. And there is a privacy setting you can change if you don't like that, where you can say only friends are able to look for me based on an email address or phone number. But yeah, Bruce Schneier's point was that, you know, these days, much like the social security number was not originally created in order to be this like very secure identification, our phone numbers are not something that we have traditionally thought would be a really important part of our security profile. And so we give it out all the time. You know, we have it in our email signatures, and yet we use our phone numbers with so many different services. We use it for, you know, two-factor authentication in many, many instances. And increasingly, there's a profile that's being, you know, developed around our phone numbers, and they're very much tied to our identities. We don't like to change them. We usually port our phone number from service to service and, you know, keep it for our whole lives. And so it is one of the backbones of Facebook's People You May Know and how it's connecting people is by looking at all these phone numbers. And I just don't think that most people, when they were kind of like setting up their personal security profile, we're thinking, oh, I need to be careful about who I give my phone number to, or this could later be used to like make a connection between us.
Yeah, it also makes me realize when Facebook's been around for a long time at this point, right? And I remember very early on signing up for Facebook, signing up for Twitter. I think I did the same thing then, having a different approach to this idea of share your contacts with us and we'll make all the connections for you. Then that seemed like a really great deal. Great, you've saved me all this time and trouble of setting all this up manually. Now I think about it a little bit differently. I think I actually do, you know, didn't consider then what I consider now, which is, am I really giving you everything that there is that I have in my phone to do with whatever you will? And to never know that you do or do not keep it forever and ever and use it for whatever you decide to use it for in the long tail. I don't know. I guess times have changed and that seems a little bit more apparent to me now. I wish it did to me then, but it wouldn't have mattered, right? Because everybody has everybody's number and you're all screwed anyways. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great point because I just don't think that Facebook was as candid as they could have been about the fact that once you uploaded your contact information, it was going to be kept forever and used to make friend recommendations for all time. And people did complain about that a year. You know, people you may know came into existence in 2008. And in 2009, when people started getting these really, you know, creepily accurate suggestions, they said, oh, I think that they're using the contact information that I gave them when we first signed up. And at the time that Facebook was confronted with that, they were really cagey about it and said, oh, the people you may know is, you know, our special sauce and we don't really talk about it. And now they're upfront about the fact that they use those contacts. But I don't think most people understand just how much analysis you can do with all this information. And right. Through the course of reporting the story, I discovered that a quarter of all my Facebook friends have handed over their contacts. And that surprised me. And if this worries you, I would recommend that you go and check out the page on Facebook for managing your contacts, and you can delete them if you don't like the fact that you've done this. But that doesn't help you with your own shadow contact information because you would need to find everyone who's ever handed your information over and ask them to delete it.
Right. And that's impossible. I mean, you make the point that like this is someone that maybe you sold something to on Craigslist a decade ago or someone, you know, that your landlord or, you know, just the most random people that end up in your contact information that I mean, I think someone should, I don't know, write a book about going around. You, Kashmir, should go around and see how hard it would be to go back in and get everyone's information off of there.
Sounds like a good story assignment.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's I feel paranoid now. I know you met like a former, like a distant family member that some of your family members didn't know about. We'll link to that article. It's amazing. But I just scroll through my people you might know, and it's mostly people that live in our small town of Petaluma. Like, you know, we're all moms, we're connected. But then the people that I don't know, I just think, is that like what, some
secret? Why are you connected to me? Why are you being presented to me? Is there something I need to know?
Yeah, ever since one of those strangers wound up being a relative I didn't know existed, every time I go through that list, I'm like, you're probably connected to me in some way that only Facebook knows. And what is it? It's like every person is a mystery to me now.
And you'll never know because as you point out in the article, Facebook considers sharing this information a privacy violation. Whose privacy? Because, I mean, when I'm not on Facebook and I choose not to share, well, I mean, I am on Facebook, but if I were not never to have gone to Facebook at all, yet my information was there, like my privacy is not necessarily being adhered to, but they're talking about Facebook users' privacy offering that information, right?
Yeah, so it's the privacy of the people who uploaded their contacts. And when you upload your contacts, it's not just like the name and the number, it's everything that you have for that contact. So if you made any, you know, notes in there, if there's a photo of somebody, you know, any old addresses you have, like everything goes over when you upload your contacts. And so if Facebook let you see your shadow contact information, it would be letting you see into the address books of the people who gave your contact information. So it might say like, oh man, you know, Jason's a real jerk and here's his number.
Probably does say that.
So I think that's how that's the privacy of those people who provided it. Which is kind of funny.
Well, I know that there's been a lot of talk lately also about like, oh, Facebook is listening to me because I'm getting delivered these ads that are, you know, or that have my picture. They're watching me. They're secretly watching me. And I know Reply All, those guys did a big episode on that, and you've been on that show before. But I think, I mean, really, it's more insidious what they're doing than just turning on our microphone and using it to track ads. Like, I don't think they're listening to us, but they are. We're giving them this information willingly.
Yeah, I know. I get this tip once a week that it feels like Facebook is listening to conversations because the ads are so accurate. But I think the real takeaway from that is that, one, you're not that unique, and you're probably part of this lookalike audience where everybody is having kind of the same conversations and talking about the same products. And then two, like, they don't need to listen because your phone just knows you so well. Mm-hmm. And there's all this other data that's flowing into Facebook. That means that they're ads are really good. Like my Instagram ads are always so good. I actually want to buy the things I see there. And yeah, Facebook knows me too well.
Well, Kashmir, thank you so much for joining us. And you are at Gizmodo now. Where's the best place to follow you online besides waiting for that book that you're going to write?
I think my Twitter is probably the best. I'm Cash Hill on Twitter.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank
Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, up next, it's never too early, apparently, to start Christmas shopping. And Amazon wants to make sure they sell you everything this year. But first, let's thank the sponsor of today's episode. This episode is brought to you by Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system that's designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but it requires no hardware purchase. They have an iOS as well as an Android app that callers can reach you on wherever you are on your mobile phone through a normal business line that's connected through your phone thanks to the app. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client's going to see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number, even though you're calling from the same device. Simply select the toll-free or local number. You can record a custom greeting, add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers, of course, awesome for marketing, and that'll make your business sound even more professional if you use it. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. You can also get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments if that makes it easier for you to manage. You can also send and receive text messages, SMS messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a full 30-day money-back guarantee to check it out. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper to save $50 on your order. Just go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. And we thank Grasshopper for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Halloween is over, and forget American Thanksgiving. It's time to start shopping for the holidays. Here to talk to us all about the tech of buying more stuff is Ben Fox Rubin, senior reporter for CNET. He covers Amazon, e-commerce, and mobile payments. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks.
So online sales, you say, are set to break $100 billion this year, according to Adobe. Is it time right now for us to start looking for deals?
I mean, it's a good idea to start looking for deals. Yes, absolutely. And especially for low inventory, high demand items, you probably want to snatch those up soon because there's a high likelihood that they are going to become out of stock later in the holiday season. However, a lot of the major retailers have already shown that they're saving all their best sales for Thanksgiving weekend. So you will have to pace yourselves, people, and wait a little bit longer before you start buying stuff, especially electronics. Wait until the holiday season. That's probably when you're going to get the best deals.
And are we expecting, as seems to have been the trend the last couple of years, that Cyber Monday is going to outpace Black Friday, which I kind of can't believe because I remember when Cyber Monday was a brand new thing and it was like, yeah, they're trying to force this new spending holiday on us. And I felt very anxious about that. But now it's like even better than Black Friday for whatever that means. But
on the online side, yes, absolutely. Cyber Monday is definitely going to outpace Black Friday. But I do believe the Black Friday will continue to be a bigger sales day for the brick and mortar. So yeah. Expect to see that. And if you do want to go out to an actual brick and mortar store, if people still do that, you might see some really good deals on Black Friday and probably Cyber Monday too. One of the interesting things that retailers have been doing in recent years has been to really elongate and extend sales. So you're not going to just see them for Black Friday or Cyber Monday. You're going to see them for 3 to 5 day stretches So wait for that too.
Another big question. Should we bother shopping anywhere else besides Amazon at this point?
that's always like an interesting question to wonder. I mean, like, I always wonder that myself going into the holidays. Target, Walmart, Best Buy, a lot of, I mean, like Etsy too. A lot of these folks are really trying to make a lot more noise, especially in the holiday season. So, but the problem is that Amazon has been and will continue to be the really, really big player. They're not only really strong with mobile and desktop, but they're also trying to make voice shopping a thing now. Granted, most people aren't voice shopping right now, but it would be an interesting additional channel that Amazon would find to take even more of your money.
Yeah, I'm curious to see the traction around Amazon, because I mean, this has been a huge year, I feel like, for Amazon. Not that Amazon was hurting prior to 2017, but they've, you know, with the acquisition of Whole Foods, obviously, you got to spend some time with the Amazon Key. They're really getting into very new and different, stepping stones for extending their business into different places. What do you think about Amazon Key? Do you, in your experience, I mean, is this a good direction for Amazon? Could that play any sort of factor? I mean, it feels kind of limited right now, but as far as this holiday is concerned.
Yeah, for this holiday season, I think it's way, way too early for Amazon Key to take over. It's really, they're just in the educating and convincing phase for Amazon Key at this point. However, I think that a big potential play for Amazon Key going forward would be professional services. So let's say you need the cable guy to show up, or a plumber, somebody like that, or a dog walker, different things like that in your house. The possibility that Amazon Key could actually provide for something like that means that that gives Amazon yet another channel again to sell you stuff, and professional services would have to go through them. So I do think it's an interesting opportunity, but at the same time, I think the level of negativity against Amazon Key and the privacy concerns around it are a significant hurdle. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but a lot of folks I've seen online do not like this service and say, hell no, we're never going to use this.
We should say a little bit about what it is, just in case people don't know. And you got to go to a press briefing where they showed it off. You haven't actually used it in your own home. To explain a little bit about how it works.
Yeah, Amazon Key is a new form of in-home delivery and also in-home services. So concept is that you have a smart door lock and a security camera set up in your home. Amazon actually launched the service publicly yesterday, and will provide free installation. It starts at $250 for the whole kit. What happens is a delivery worker shows up at your door, is able to unlock your door using their phone, just cracks the door open a little, slides a package in, closes the door, and then the door locks again. So a couple months from now, they're also planning on integrating this service with professional services, as I mentioned before, where a dog walker could conceivably unlock your door while you're not there, walk in, walk your dog, and then bring your dog back home. Or a maid service could show up, clean your house, and then leave afterward. This is something that, you know, obviously if you have a maid service that regularly comes to your house, maybe they already have your key, so you don't think this is particularly foreign already. But for a lot of people, they were kind of freaked out about it. And that is understandable. It is a new type of service, and it is a nascent space.
So earlier in the show, we talked to a New York Times reporter who talked to a woman who had her 3-year-old son had been shown a really traumatic YouTube video on YouTube Kids. And then she continued to use YouTube Kids. And I'm not judging her at all. I'm just saying, like, she did it because it was convenient. And I do, like, I'm going to go on record saying, I think for those people who have trouble with people stealing their packages or not, you know, not getting their packages, I'm going to say that always, in my experience, convenience people have chosen convenience over privacy. A certain amount of people, a majority of people, I might even say.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is the reason that I think this particular service is interesting is that I cover e-commerce, I cover the future of commerce, and this is one of those few services to show up that has the potential to really change the way we shop. I was talking to one smart door lock provider, it's the CEO, the company's name is Latch. He was talking about the idea of potentially integrating your smart door lock with your Uber ride and a food delivery service where you would have a hot plated meal sitting and waiting for you at your dinner table when you walk in the front door. I mean, like, how incredible is that? And all you would have to do is offer these tech companies just a little bit more of your privacy or just a little bit more of your information. So maybe people are going to go for it. I personally think that's like a pretty wild and pretty cool idea, but who's to know if it's actually going to take off?
And this is technology and innovation in air quotes that we're talking about. So you better believe that we're going to see that in the next, you know, next coming months, I'm sure. What I'm curious about for the holidays is it seems like every year there's like there's a certain category of technology that is really hot that people are really flocking to. I feel like last year we heard a lot of buzz, at least leading up to the holidays, around VR. And now, you know, those platforms have seen significant price cuts. What do you think? Like, what's going to be the hot technology this holiday? Is VR in the mix or is it something else?
So Adobe put together a whole list of the hot top tech that they found related to. They scrape like social information, what people are actually looking at. AirPods, I thought was interesting, was the top of the list. Wow. You also see PlayStation VR there. Google Home and Amazon Echo, I'm not surprised that they actually also made the list because the smart speakers have really been gaining traction the past couple of years. I don't know about you guys, but AirPods, I've definitely been seeing around a lot more lately. Mm-hmm. They're priced at a certain point where it's a nice gift to give somebody if you really like them, but they're well over $100. So it's not like a stocking stuffer. But at the same time, if a lot of people have been talking about it on social, as Adobe has been saying, you're probably going to see a lot of those being gifted over the holiday season. And obviously, they're a lot easier to get your hands on than an iPhone X. So, yeah, look for that, too.
My guess is that's going to go to a lot of, like, teenage kids, and, you know, because nobody knows what to buy teenagers. And all you know is that they have an iPhone in front of their face constantly. And
you're so right.
What goes with that? So, yeah, this is so my experience with voice search has been that if I've ever done that through the Amazon Echo, it's always been way more expensive if I've gone back and checked the price. So is there any way that voice search will you can get deals through voice search? Are they really just doing that for people who value, like I said, convenience over cost?
Yeah, great question. This is definitely an area that I've looked at a lot as far as voice shopping. According to an IFTTT survey that I wrote about a week or two ago, really only 5% of the people surveyed have ever actually used voice search. I personally have only made one purchase using voice search, using an Amazon Echo, and it was during Prime Day, and the deal was like so ridiculously good that I knew that I didn't even have to check the price or shop around. And what you're mentioning is a big reason why I think a lot of people don't like voice search, and it's because price comparisons just really aren't that possible. It's possible sometime in the future, the Echo Show, which includes like a tablet screen on it, maybe it'll make it a little bit easier to do price comparisons. But until they do that, and until they actually provide you with like a little bit more options, I think voice search might not really take off for the time being.
Yeah, I've tried the Echo Show too. Right now they give you, like, if you ask for paper towels, they give you five choices, and you know, so you can't really search, and you can't compare anywhere else, like eBay or Walmart or Target or anything like that. So, and I don't think they would be doing that anytime soon.
Yeah, the other problem is like anytime I've done voice search, you get really annoyed or bored if you don't get what you want after the second option. Nobody really wants to wait for the third or fourth or fifth option. So it's easier with the Echo Show, but at the same time, it's kind of like, you know, like the I'm feeling lucky button on Google, where unless it's the number one option, you're immediately like not going to get that interested. So that's another hurdle for voice shopping going forward.
Well, Ben has lots more tips in his article on CNET and many more articles about Amazon and all kinds of e-commerce. And I'm sure you'll be posting more throughout the season when people begin shopping. Ben Fox Rubin is a senior reporter at CNET, and he is Ben Fox Rubin on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ben. We'll talk to you soon. All right. And finally, we talked a little bit about VR. Well, very briefly, AR and VR. Certainly a lot of fun, but the experience can transcend mere entertainment value and go further and allow people to connect with the digital world on a much deeper level. 8i Studios, based out of Culver City, California, allows for the recording of photorealistic holograms that can later be viewed in VR, kind of a time capsule taken to another level. And joining us to talk about the emotional impact of volumetric video and the technology that drives it is Ben Stein, general manager of 8i Studios. How are you doing, Ben?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you on to talk about this. I will admit I saw a video on The Verge. Lauren Good did a tour and got to play around with your technology. And it was just a really cool glimpse into something that I feel we're going to see a lot more of going forward. And I'm sure you would hope that to be the case. Give us a little history on 8i. What was the vision behind the company? What's the primary focus for your efforts at this point?
Yeah, for sure. So we're a technology company through and through, really a software company that brings the easiest way to create and experience photorealistic human holograms. Today, that's in virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality. Eventually, it'll be a naked eye projection technology. We're not developing that technology, but we're going to make sure our holograms look really beautiful there as well. The company was started by some folks at Peter Jackson's Weta out in New Zealand, and they were working on some deep R&D there, saw that first Oculus headset and thought, this is going to be, the way that lots of people are experiencing content, and how are we going to put people in there? And not avatars, not sort of dealing with this uncanny valley issue, but how are we going to have volumetric videos that give people a real sense of presence with these assets? And so that's something we've been working on for about 4 years at 8i, and we have sort of really been bringing that to the market in the last 12 months or so.
And I mean, when you see the video that The Verge did, you kind of get a little bit of a sense of the studio that you're shooting a lot of these experiences in. The video seems to hinge around a mother with a newborn baby at first, but she goes in regularly to kind of record her experiences with her child in this high-tech studio that you guys have designed, and then to be able to go into VR, I assume with motion tracking after the fact, and basically be reacquainted with her younger child, almost frozen in time. Can you talk a little bit about the technology and this kind of idea of this time capsule sort of approach?
Yeah, for sure. What Lauren's sharing there is a project that we've been working on for a while. It really represents a very specific type of use case of this technology, and that's sort of a legacy or a family photo album type use case for the technology. Today, the stage that you see there is our stage here in Playa Vista in LA. It's the place that you can capture these assets in the States at the moment. And so we've been working with this mother, Ashley, and her daughter, Reese. She came in for a project a few years back on a previous stage of ours when she had a newborn and captured a message to that newborn, a message to her, 2-month-old baby, 3-month-old baby at the time. And then over the years, she's come in multiple times to sort of see those holograms and record her children as they grow up and continue recording these messages to her children. And I think one of the most touching moments that our CEO, Steve Raymond, talked about with Lauren in the video that was featured on The Verge was the first time that Ashley came in to see the hologram of herself and that baby, she stepped into her own body. She put her hands the way that you would put while you're holding your baby, and she was able to experience her own child. And it was only 6 months previous, but clearly her baby had grown up a lot in the last 6 months, and that was an incredibly touching moment for her. And again, it represents a single use case for this technology, but we do think that in the not-too-distant future, the capture rigs will be significantly more distributed, and the average people will be able to go in and capture their family in this way. And then they'll be able to have sort of a volumetric photo album of their family, and they'll be able to experience these moments with their children from the past as their children get older.
Wow. So I tried one. You have an iPhone and an Android app. I tried the Holo app this afternoon.
Great.
I put a little Buzz Aldrin in our studio. I shrunk him. I made him big. He said he should go to Mars. It was really fun. Put a tiger, put a raccoon on.
Yeah, the raccoon scared me. By surprise.
It was
people and animals.
Yeah.
It's really great at people and animals, living things. Yeah.
Right. So it was all really fun. And, I've tried a lot of these, and it's much more realistic than some of them that I've tried. And I mean, I'm using the iPhone 10, so it's got the most, up-to-date technology. But the use case, I know you just said it was a single use case, baby and mom. I was out with a dozen of my friends last night. We all have teenagers except one who has a teenager and then went and had another baby. And, we all love like playing with our baby, but we were excited to give it back. And I said, here's this person I'm going to interview tomorrow. Here's what they're doing. Like you go in when you have a baby and then you can go, back after, you know, years, and you have this, you can hold your baby again. And they all just looked at me like, oh, that is so creepy in Black Mirror. And I'm sure I'm not the only person that said that to you. So what do you say to that?
I mean, I don't think we have a response for the Black Mirror factor. I think there's a lot of things about our life right now that could have been episodes of the first season of the Black Mirror. I think that there's something to be said for what this mother experiences when she steps into this and has that experience with her own children. There's, you know, you mentioned Buzz Aldrin that you had that brief experience with in our Hollow app. That was part of a much bigger project that we did with Buzz and Time Magazine last year. It was released at South by Southwest. Yeah, there's Buzz. Looks like he's in your office.
Yeah.
Captured for a VR experience. And, you know, what that was really meant to be was a legacy piece for Buzz. He's had a vision for decades of how he thinks we as a civilization should go to Mars. Buzz knows he's likely not going to be around when we go to Mars. He's in his late 80s. And, you know, we were able to capture this message from Buzz and the vision for how he thinks we should go to Mars. And today, the way to experience that is in a 10-minute, you know, high-fidelity, 6-degree-of-freedom VR experience. In the future, you'll be able to walk into the Smithsonian and experience Buzz in a way that's very different than seeing a 2D photo or a 2D video. And so I think there's this aspect that it might feel creepy today, but I think that, you know, this ability to capture people with the volume, with the depth, with that sense of presence that you get by viewing our assets in AR, VR is something that's going to be incredibly powerful in the future.
Yeah, and being able to capture these things and then go back and experience them the way it was back then, like it goes another level than just taking a picture or recording a video. I'm sure you remember Google Glass. I had a pair of Google Glass when my youngest daughter was right about to start walking, and at the spur of the moment, I was able to put the glass on, hit record, and I was able to capture her first steps as she walked to daddy, you know, from my perspective. And I will always cherish that because I can remember what it was like when she looked into my eyes and smiled while she was walking towards me. It was like you captured something more than just a picture or a video. You captured a memory. And it really seems like that's what you're doing here. I could see this being huge. But you've also talked about other things that the studio can be used for, this being one facet, your app being another. What are some other visions that you have for this technology?
Yeah, so for sure, there's definitely entertainment applications. We have partners that are building interactive, you know, whether it's VR, AR programs. Pardon me if there's a little bit of noise in the background. There's a trash truck out there. But you know, we're working with some retail partners as well, that whether it's an advertising model, you walk by a store, you get a notification, there's a hologram wearing an outfit that's in that store, or more of an e-commerce model using their app or their web AR tools to be able to see the outfit on a model that you're interested in purchasing. It might not replace the photo of that outfit today. As the fidelity continues to get better, you know, we think it could absolutely replace the photo. Today, it's another way to see how the fit and the fabric moves on the human body. Right. So that's for retail. We're also working on B2B projects around training and things like that as well, both for AR and VR, that there's partners who are, you know, creating training experiences specifically for their own organizations where they're not only training in VR, but testing and tying employee results to those sorts of testing in a way that's pretty unique.
So there are a lot of companies doing similar things right now. There's a lot, like AR is the big deal. It was VR, now it's AR is all the rage. What makes your company different than what else is out there?
Yeah, I mean, we are a very specific piece of this market. We're focused on human capture, reconstruction, distribution, and playback across every platform. We're not a VR company. We're not an AR company. We're not a naked eye live projection company. We've decided to focus on a very specific part of this that we think is going to be important in every reality. If you think about film and television today, there's great animated features and there's great CG visual effects packed films and shows out there. But a lot of the content that people are experiencing, whether it's in entertainment or in advertising or in any of these other mediums, journalism, needs real people. And that's the real thing that we're creating. And that's the real big problem that we're solving as a company, is we're bringing people to these immersive environments.
And tigers.
And tigers. Living objects. Nothing static. Living objects.
No chairs.
No chairs.
We got to move a little bit.
You could shoot a chair on our stage. It's just not the best way to do it.
And you know what? That's been done. I like the Buzz Aldrin approach. Not many people are recording Buzz Aldrin in volumetric video. Ben Stein with 8i. That's the number 8, the letter i.com, if you want to find out more about what they're doing. And I love it. I love this idea of getting closer and preserving preserving memories and being able to kind of navigate something that you're familiar with later by throwing on the goggles in this one example. And you got to feel good about the fact that Apple, there's news, or at least sources are saying that Apple is interested in designing a headset of some sort for AR or VR that might come out in 2020. That gives at least a little bit of extra confidence that this is here for, in the long run. Would you agree?
I mean, we're very confident with or without that news, yeah, but absolutely, yeah. It's helpful to hear that. I mean, I think something like ARKit, bringing the tracking to the operating system, both for ARKit and ARCore for Android, we saw noticeable bumps in our traffic in our Holo app just from those sort of minor things. So,
sure.
Yeah, absolutely, new headsets from these incumbent hardware manufacturers and things like that. It's definitely a good sign for us, because we think no matter what those platforms are and which hardware providers are the most successful, they're all going to need people in these 3D environments.
Yeah, right on. Ben Stein, 8i.com. Thank you for talking with us today, Ben, and best of luck with everything you're doing there. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right. Have a good night. All right. Finally, if you already don't trust your home assistants to keep your best held secrets a secret, now you can't trust them to resist throwing a party while you're out of the house. In Germany, apparently, an apartment dweller who owns an Amazon Echo went out for the evening. He left a dark, empty, and above all, quiet space behind. Somewhere around 2 a.m., the Echo decided it was party time and began playing party music at full volume. That disturbed the neighbors who were close by living right around him, who ultimately called the police to investigate the raging party that was happening in the apartment. None of the digital party goers would open the door, surprisingly enough, when the cops came knocking, so they ordered a locksmith to come down around 3 a.m. to do their magic. And once they got in, they found no actual people, but a, quote, black jukebox, which is usually activated by voice control as being the noise culprit. So now your Amazon Echo wants to throw parties while you're out of the house. You can't even trust the Echo anymore.
Yeah, mine hasn't done that, but it has just randomly gone off with my flash briefing. And the one at the studio does, too, like in Jerry's office. We were just walking by and it was playing the Tonight Show or something like that. Like, it was playing the flash briefing. Sometimes when I get home from work and my family's been there, like the Echo Show is unplugged. I'll find it unplugged, and I'll know that means that she did something to upset my husband, and then she gets the plug kicking out. He just says, like, she just was doing stuff.
Weird. And, yeah. It's haunted Echo.
Your Google Home doesn't do that?
Doesn't just go off randomly that I know of. But, I mean, you know, we all heard of the issue with the Google Home Mini when that was first coming out, where it was recording all sorts of things and sending it to the cloud. So you never know.
Right. That's
the problem. Apparently, this guy had to pay for the bill for the locksmith. Couldn't get out of that. He said he had no idea how it happened. No windows were open that a command could be heard through or anything like that. Amazon has not commented. So maybe there's more here that we don't know about. I don't know.
The other fun thing is that sometimes my kids will pair their phone to the speaker and then they'll forget that it's paired.
Oh, no.
So, like, I'll be making breakfast or something, and then my kids get up and I can hear their Snapchats and stuff. And I don't tell them. It's my secret parenting tip.
Oh, boy. They can get themselves in some trouble there. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday around 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, something GMT. I didn't look it up. I'm sorry. I'll do that for next week. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv and subscribe to our show at twit.tv/tnw.
What are your favorite segments of this show or other shows or moments in Twit this year? We're putting together our best of episodes and we need your help. I know we've only had 6 episodes. Is this number 6 or 5?
This is number 6.
6. So I know we've had a lot of really great moments.
Oh, man. Pretty much every interview could be in the best of.
Head over to twit.tv/best of. Fill out the form, whatever information you remember, and you can be part of making these special shows that will air between Christmas and New Year's. And if you want to tweet at me for all your secrets of when you're a scholar has acted on his or her own, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Josh. Thanks to Colleen. Thanks to Evan Harris, who's an in-studio guest here today watching the show recorded live. It's great to have you here, Evan. And thanks to you for watching Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all next week. Have a great weekend. Bye. Bye. Bye-bye.